We made this.
And welcome to the X-Cast. The truth is in here. I'm your host, Annie Flowers, and today my guest is Russell Hugo. So how are you doing today, Russ?
Doing fine. Life is busy, but I'm really happy to be able to take a break and talk about the X-Files with you. Thanks so much for letting me join you.
Thank you for joining me in the middle of the day to discuss this season 8 episode. What are your feelings on season 8?
Overall, I admire it. I think production-wise, I really think the team has gotten to the top of their game. It looks great in general. The staging is great. Everybody's there. Some of the plot developments and overall plot arc aren't as solid as to my liking, let me put it that way, as maybe some others. But I admire what they're trying to do. I really appreciate Robert Patrick's performance and the character of Doggett. I think some of the attempts to hang on and drag out and reiterate the previous mythology aren't always as successful. And as the show shifts later into the super soldier arc, I find that a bit on the rough side. And I know that's kind of leading into season 9, but it's kind of hinting at things. But there are a lot of things I generally enjoy. Some of the individual episodes necessarily aren't as strong as maybe previous seasons, but as a whole, I'm glad it exists. How about you?
Oh, well, it's not one that I revisit often. I watched it during the original run, and then, gosh, it was pre-COVID. So 3, maybe 4 years ago, about 3 years ago with my husband, we rewatched it. He's a big Doggett fan, just likes what a solid, good guy he is. And I gained an appreciation for season 8. Not all of the storylines work for me. I'm not a big fan of pregnant Scully and some of that stuff, but it's okay. I have an appreciation for it now. And some of the darker episodes, seasons 6 and 7, while fun and very rewatchable, are not as dark as I like. Maybe like, you know, stuff from season 3 or even season 4 is a little bit darker. And seasons 6 and 7 got pretty light. So I am enjoying that dark aspect of it. So yeah, overall, it's not bad.
I think I echo that really well. Like as an example, even though it is a tough watch, something like Roadrunners, I again have to admire the attempt to head back to a rougher season 2 tone. And that's it. So I did echo, if I may plagiarize much of what you stated.
Sure. Plagiarize away. I won't sue you. This is all free anyway. But yeah, today's episode is Sure Kill, which is a darker episode. It originally aired on January 7th, 2001. And this is the 8th episode of the 8th season, written by Greg Walker, who also wrote Brand X and Empedocles, and is directed by Terrence O'Hara. And I believe this is the only X-Files credit to his name, if I'm not mistaken.
That's what I was able to find, yeah.
Yeah, okay, great. And in this episode, Doggett and Scully investigate 2 shady brothers who run a rat extermination business, one of whom may be a killer with X-ray vision, basically your classic Monster of the Week episode, only instead of Mulder, we have Doggett. And what's your rating out of 10 for this one?
As just a refresher for the listeners, I generally rate on a curve. So I actually fill out the lower end and I fill out the high end. So as opposed to the IMDb, which skews more 6 to 9, I'm going to have to put this probably down around a 3.5.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And now, to be fair, that means I have an equal distribution of episodes. So there has to be generally equal throughout the series. Comparing to the rest of the X-Files episodes, I'd put this probably in the 3 to 3.5 range.
Wow. Okay. Wow. That's much lower than I thought. And so have you ranked all of the episodes then?
No, but just in my head, in your general. Head. Okay. Yeah, this is cheating off the cuff.
Got it. Got it.
What about you? What would you rate this as?
So something that would be that low, a 3.5, would have to be like really offensive. Whereas this episode, I find more bland than anything. It's not necessarily offensive that I have found anyway. Maybe you'll point something out that I missed. So I would probably go with a 5.5.
Yeah. And again, it's just the fact that I just like to have an equal distribution. So my 3.5 is probably pretty similar to your 5.5.
Okay.
That's fair. So it just would mean that about 70% of the X-Files episodes out there are better than this episode, is how I'm trying to rate that.
When you put it that way, that does make sense. It's not a great episode.
Everybody's got different ratings, rating metrics and all the rest. So that's, 5.5 is I think a very respectable rating for this episode. And it would be very happy to know that it received that.
Someone out there who worked very hard on this episode would be.
There's a lot of people, it seems, who worked hard. And that's one thing when we get into it, we'll be praising quite a bit of the crew on this. Just goes back to show like really how impressive and hardworking the X-Files crew was, even on a Monster of the Week like this late in the game.
Yeah, absolutely. So with that, let's dig in. We open at night with a payphone. One of the things that I do like about this episode is the callback to all the 90s and 2000 stuff that we just like don't think about anymore. So the minute I saw the payphone, I was really excited. I don't know about you.
Yeah, I don't know if this is the right time to jump ahead, but I was even more shocked later when we learned that the setup here, that he's going to this payphone, he's being chased by this killer, and he's making a call. It's a local call. On a calling card.
Yeah.
I was thinking, I wish we could have seen that. They'd wind back a little bit more. We see him typing in the number and then, waiting for that and then to the calling card number, then the PIN, and then calling the number to do it. Just seems like, it'd be an attention killer. But I haven't thought about calling cards for a long time either, not just the payphones. It was a treat.
Well, I don't think you're jumping too far ahead. I mean, that comes fairly early. Are you saying when we find out about it? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, about the calling card.
Got it. When that actually comes into play. Yes, because he makes the call very quickly. Never in my dreams would I have thought that he had a calling card with him. I mean, if someone's chasing me and trying to kill me, I'm not going to take out my calling card and start dialing all the numbers. I mean, time is of the essence here. But yeah, that was really funny as well. There are a couple things like that. So this man is running, he falls, gets up, stumbles into a police station. They put him in this cell and he's still panicking, screaming that someone's going to kill him. How effective do you find this?
Some of my notes when I was taking down notes while I was watching, was that the editing here and the photography, a lot of the setup for the staging for the cold open was over the top. And I don't necessarily mean that in a negative way. It's doing all it can to make this as exciting as possible. And the production team is, again, doing their best. The interesting opening there, where it transitions from the alleged live shot to the television, and then it swings around. And mm-hmm. You can see the mirror effect that you're seeing the security camera doing it, which doesn't really play too much into the story because it's not like security cameras come back. I mean, I guess there's vision, but it's not in the same sense. It was just kind of a trick that they did that seemed like it would take quite a bit of time, but they took the time to do it. And then you've got a lot of quick edits. You got a lot of Dutch angles. And then when they throw him in the drunk tank, as an example, they got that really nice overhead shot. Well, they must have. The set was fairly well constructed, especially when you go later with the investigation we'll get into with Scully. Mm-hmm. But the camera is just constantly moving. There's a lot of focus pulls, and whoever is doing the DP work on this and the editing is really helping to make it effective. So in general, I think the cold open, because of the pacing, is one of the stronger aspects of the episode. How about you?
I liked everything that you said. I didn't even think about it with the security cameras and how that doesn't come into play later, but it is cool visually. The one thing that I will say, and maybe I just don't know what it's like to have to run for my life, but I did find the acting over the top and cheesy. Something about it didn't quite work for me. Otherwise, I thought it was really cool, especially when he is within these brick walls in a police station. The police officer tells him that obviously he's never been safer in his life. And then his brains or blood smatters like across the splatters across the little window. And I'm like, all right, I'm in. How did that happen? Because I don't know about you, but I don't remember this episode at all. I haven't watched it in years. And so it was kind of like rediscovering it. So I thought that aspect was very cool. My one complaint, and again, never had to run for my life. So maybe that is what it would be like. I just found something about it didn't work.
If I can echo that, and not to give up the ghost too much, that's an issue throughout the episode for me, is the director is trying to match a tone. If you look at their other work prior to this, I'd looked up like Star Trek Voyager, Touched by an Angel, Dr. Quinn, Dark Angel. That's generally the tier of, or style. I don't want to make like a remark about quality, but the tone that they've worked in the past. And you look at some of the acting choices, and if I'm going to kind of put that on the director, because it seems to mimic much more of those genres of television that doesn't quite mesh with what we're used to in the X-Files. And I would agree throughout, in general, quite a few of the guest performances are quite a bit over the top. But to be fair, I could also state that the script itself sometimes forces some of the actors to do some extra work there, and finding that balance can be difficult. But I definitely agree, there were quite a few times I was taken out of it where some of the acting was a little campy. They were really playing to the camera. So I totally agree with you.
Right. And especially when you juxtapose that with how cool and level-headed Scully and Doggett are, there's not a lot of emoting from them. Whereas as you said, the guest actors might be acting in a different style. From there, we go to the credits, and I haven't seen these credits in years, and it was jarring to me. I don't know if you're used to them, but I'm not.
No, but I like it.
You do like it. Okay.
Yeah. I like the change and I like the tone. Again, the originals are fabulous, but they are, I think, is it season 9 where they switch? Because maybe I blanked it out. This one, does this have the child standing on the hill and it zooms into his eyeball, or is that just in season 9?
I don't remember seeing that.
Am I imagining this? But I seem to imagine that thing. These feel pretty good, like the shots were of the new badges, and then when it cuts to both Scully and Doggett, maybe in a forest from a different episode or whatever. I think it looks well. It looks nice. I generally like the, it's a fresh new season. We've got a new actor. And if you're going to update the credits, I thought they did a fairly good job.
They did do a good job. I wasn't ready emotionally. I'm doing a full series rewatch. And so I'm somewhere in the middle of season 6. And to go from that to the new credits, I was very surprised. And I knew it was coming, but it didn't matter. I was still surprised. But I don't know anything about a child standing on a hill. Season 9, I haven't seen in a long time. But it has Mulder falling into Scully's eye. Do you remember that?
I do. Oh, yeah. Okay. That's a very interesting choice. But it's a difficult thing to stage using the technology at the time. I thought it looks good. Like they pulled it off. They pulled off the effect. Was it the right thing to do? It's debatable, but it's an interesting choice. And I don't even mean that as a backhanded compliment. I'm just, it's an odd one. And in some senses, I admire the boldness of that degree of in your face symbolism.
But, right.
Yeah. I just, for some reason in my head, and I don't watch season 9 very often either. I'm with you there. I'm a bad X-Files fan in that level. But in my head, I seem to remember where they really amp up the CG in the credits, but this could just be all in my head. And it could all just me going back to having a traumatic experience, dipping back into the X-Files when it was originally airing and seeing scary monsters. And the CG and the plotting of that episode just kind of all blends into like, oh, this is now like a PlayStation game. Which is unfair, but that was just the little snippets I saw. So in my head there, the credits could get worse. The organic textures of this existing season 8 credits in that context, I think work well. And I want to cheer them on for that reason.
I will report back when I get to season 9 and let you know.
Please do.
Right. So then we open in Massachusetts with Scully, who is describing what she sees on an X-ray of a cracked skull. Doggett kind of gives her a rundown of what happened. There are no holes in the walls. And I think a police officer comes in with a ladder. And he's like, no, it came in through the vent. Or Scully said it must have come in from the ceiling. And that's when the police officer comes in with the ladder and he unscrews the vent, where then they go to investigate both the vent, realizing that it came from even higher, the roof. And you step outside and it just screams Los Angeles. I don't know what about it. I don't know if I saw any palm trees or anything, but it feels like LA to me when they're out up top on the roof. You know what? Why don't you tell me what you think of this scene and then we'll go on from there.
Yeah, feel free to edit some things out. But one thing I wanted to ask you is, well, especially some of these points, I'm just curious. During the cold open, to jump back there, the soundtrack to me felt really familiar, but I couldn't place it. And I mean, it sounded much like as a throwback to season one or two, like I'd heard the music before, and I wasn't sure if you made that connection, or maybe it's just I've listened to the soundtracks too many times on CD and I'm making the connection, but it feels much older than the season eight, the style that Mark Snow was doing at the time. But
it could be. I don't remember exactly the music from the cold open, but I don't know. I know that they'll do like a variation on the, what I call the ethnic theme. Anytime they have like Native Americans or someone of the Asian cultures on the show, they'll do that like pan pipe. Right. And it's vaguely ethnic. So they could have been doing something like that. I don't know.
It just had a flashback. I thought, well, they're really trying to harken back to the golden age of tombs or something from the season one. There's a lot of similarities between this plotline and Tombs to some degree. And so I just was wondering if maybe that was a little bit more intentional.
It could be. I don't know. I didn't catch that.
Also, I don't mean to like run the show here, but I was going to get your thoughts about the writer. So prior to this, as far as I can tell from IMDb, the only credit that he had done other than the other X-Files stuff is a Harsh Realm episode reunion. And I mean, there's a few other things about that, but it was only like standalone script there. And there's a lot of tonal shifts here, even though they had kind of started off in 10-13, it kind of shows maybe how difficult it can be to sometimes write an X-Files episode, particularly in season eight, and find that balance right.
Sure.
There's a lot of quirks here that are attempted at humor that we'll get into them as they go, that necessarily, I'm not sure how intentional they are or how well it lands. And then mixed with some of the logical issues, there's some problems. And just as a highlight, one thing it's the attempt at, I'm assuming it's an attempt at humor, but I mean, the episode opens with somebody being chased whose last name is Chase. And then you know, we have like right out of the gate. And then you have issues with this example with the, and I know it's difficult to do with the spacing, but where the whole entire thing is built around this logic puzzle. It is the mystery of like, how did this person get murdered in this enclosed space? It's a classic Holmesian setup. The person is, from what I remember from the cold open, is right next to the door. And then we see the person die. They later come in and they're investigating the space. They bring the stepladder into the center of the cube. And then there is the vent in the center of the little cube, the cell where he's been stored.
Right.
They go up and the bullet is essentially going straight up. But somehow it's implied that it is going 4 or 5 feet after leaving the vent towards the door to go straight down through the top of the person's head. It's this sort of a thing to where there's certain details, which is fine. I mean, it's the X-Files, but X-Files is generally, I think, tries to do a better job about these things, about figuring out the little details, like how does the vision actually work? And throughout the episode, it keeps changing what the rules are about it. And there's so many setups that are there for the gimmick without thinking about, would anyone actually do this? What's the motivation of the characters? Or what are the actual details? There's a little bit of magic. And I think that's where the editors come in and do an excellent job of keeping the pace up, so you generally don't think about it too much or you're not too bothered. But it's like the calling card thing again at the beginning. Like if you really think about what's happening before and after this, this one of my issues with the episode is that the more you dwell on it, because it is a box of tricks, if those tricks really don't hold up and then the humor doesn't hold up, it's a little bit trickier for me. And I'm sorry to go off tangent and steer the thing, but I kind of want to start there and get your take on those three here.
Well, yes. to the logic of it, specifically with the bullet. Look, I've held a gun once and I didn't like it. I don't know anything about shooting, but everything that you said makes sense. I'm just kind of going along with it. Like, this is TV or movie logic where you're like, okay, I'm on board for the ride. So I can suspend disbelief there. I don't know if, you know, Scully puts the pencil straight through the roof. And so I don't know if that would go in more at an angle, had he shot at an angle. And I don't know.
My thought was just as going from the roof down 6 feet or whatever. I don't know how, I guess that's not more like 10 feet because they could stand up there. And right. Then it is getting to the vent. So you couldn't go at too much of an angle and then hit and then go down. I mean, you could hypothetically to some degree, but because everything seems very straight up and down, it's possible it could all work. And I guess my point was some of the elements like Scully in this episode get some good stuff to do when it comes to the detective work, and the pencil trick and all the rest is one of the highlights of the episode. So it's just that some of the spacing, because they put a lot of work into, okay, this is how we're going to solve it, then Doggett finds this. But the overall explanation of how the space is working, and later on we'll get into it, how things interacted, why the characters behaving in these spaces in these way, and how it would function. They thought through some things so well, but then other things aren't. It's a bit tricky for me, but not to belabor the point any further. As like I said, I think I played laser tag. That's pretty much the extent of my gun knowledge. And I saw
laser tag is fun. Yeah.
So that's it.
Well, not to skip too far, you know what? I'm just going to wait until we get there. But I have a similar comment about something once we get into the episode a little bit further. Up on the roof, Doggett finds the little piece of paper, or not paper towel, the little piece of towel, calls it the Godfather trick. I did not remember this from The Godfather, I must admit. So I found that really interesting. Did you get a kick out of that reference?
Honestly, I just assumed it was a general comment about the mob. And it's been too long. It's probably been 15 years since I've seen The Godfather Part 2, because I checked the wiki and I guess that's where it's from. So I'm going to claim ignorance and shame on that point as well.
Okay, wonderful. We are not cinephiles here. We are just regular files, I guess. So Scully and Doggett get into this banter about, not banter necessarily, but they're talking about how this could be possible. Scully mentions thermal imaging technology. And I found it cool that Doggett had tested that in the Marines, right? He said the Marines?
I think so. Yeah. Okay. This was a fun discussion. I agree.
Yeah. Yeah. And I have to say, I found them mostly kind of boring throughout the episode, but I did enjoy this part that they're both intelligent people. They're talking it out. There's a liveliness that I feel their interactions lack. But that's not to say that they're not both intelligent people, and I respect them both. Both their theories and being able to kind of bounce off each other, which I respected. Do you have anything else to say on this point?
Just echo and steal what you're stating. This is one of the few interactions that really lands for me throughout the episode. Both actors do a good job. I think overall, Anderson gets a little bit more to do. And considering some of the script work that she's given later, as always, does an excellent job. Just repeating the obvious, but it goes to show what a pro she is, that she could deliver some of those lines with the sincerity that she does and pull it off, is a testament to her talent and the rest. But throughout the rest of the episode, I found the interactions with them don't land. They seem forced, and often the attempts at comedy don't work. And without Duchovny there to maybe ad-lib things, it's partially maybe part of the problem. But this was a highlight.
Definitely agree with that. And I am glad you brought up some of the comedy. I look forward to getting into that in a little bit. But yeah, why do you think it is that the rest of their scenes don't really work as well? What happened there?
It's hard to know where this rests, but I think it goes back to two issues here. And I would love to get your take on this.
Sure.
One is the direction and two is the writing. We talked a little bit about the direction already and that it's a little bit over the top and a little tonally different than what we're used to in the X-Files. So there isn't a lot of space for real gravitas. It's very by the numbers television, but yet I feel, and this goes back into the writing to a degree, it's being influenced by the oncoming storm of prestige television around the time, in the sense of you hear a slur that you would not have heard in earlier seasons used twice in this episode. There's another element which we won't skip ahead to, one or two that I think is trashy. I'll go as far as to say is exploitative, unnecessary, and gross, and really hurts the episode. And I think there's this attempt of them trying to figure out what it is that makes prestige television. And it doesn't leave a lot of room for what we're used to, like you mentioned, intelligent discussions, because they want to amp up these particular dramatic elements with the guest cast primarily. So even our primary actors, a lot of the times they'll arrive at a space and it's completely coincidental or based around the events of what the characters, the external characters or the guest characters are doing at that time. So the timing of the episode is very much controlled by that. And Scully and Doggett are very, very secondary throughout this episode. So I know I threw a lot out there, but it's I hope some of that makes sense. That's kind of where, I'm approaching this going forward in their relationship and why I think that their dynamic is really hindered throughout after this point, because the focus really starts to get the tracks go out from under them, if it might be the better expression.
Yeah, it always feels like they're a couple steps behind. They're never really affecting the plot at all. They're lucky if they make it just after a crime happens. And without skipping too far ahead, although I guess I am, they solve nothing in the end, really. So it is rather disappointing for two very intelligent characters. But I don't know. I don't know. I wish I had better words for it. So their interactions after this just don't work for me. And it almost feels like in season 7, when Scully's, or maybe Gillian Anderson, is bored and she doesn't have anything to do and she's tired of the character. But I don't think that's necessarily true for the rest of season 8. And admittedly, it's been a while since I've watched it. I wish I had more to compare it to. But listening to the first couple of episodes for season 8 on the X-Cast, it seems like it was more lively. There had been this kind of rejuvenation with the cast and crew, with the new stories that they could tell. And so I was kind of hoping for that, and I didn't find it, unfortunately.
Yeah, and I didn't pull away from it that Anderson was bored, in the sense of, I think she's such a professional. She's giving her all, but
I didn't mean to say that. I'm so sorry.
No.
She's awesome, but just, I didn't mean to say that. That was terrible.
No, I don't think you did. I think okay. I think what I was stating could have been inferred that way, or I might have. And so I'm just clarifying that.
From you. Okay.
Okay. So, because I think there's a point of where the performance is of what they're given to do is very boring. And that I think a standard actor would be bored by this. And you could easily infer from her performance that she's bored, but she's such a pro that she's still giving it her all.
Yes.
But so I wasn't trying I wasn't trying to focus on what you were saying, because I think what you're getting at is totally true. That this, if I was in their space, and I guess, Robert Patrick knew, so he's still probably not as bored with this degree.
Right.
But to end up in an episode at this point, she's not given a lot to do. And some of the dialogue is so uncomfortable and wooden. How could you not be? And I think it's going to come through in the performance because of the content of the script, is what I'm trying to say.
And that's a good point.
Regardless of her performance. So if you're getting, or I'm getting, any subconscious boredom, I think it's besides, regardless of how much she's putting in, you can't save it, no matter how passionate you are, unless you wanted to, again, amp up into an over-the-top performance, right, where the director is pushing, because that's what they're having to compete against. It's one of those things people bring up when they talk about, like, Nick Cage, if somebody's in a Nick Cage movie, like, having to act against that. How do you meet that level and find that? And some directors know how to work with that. And it goes back to, again, to the comment I was making about prestige television. And you think about when there's the big boom of, like, Tarantino ripoffs in the 90s, and how many people got what he was doing. And regardless of how you feel about his work, this seems to me a director and a writer who's trying to ape what they saw the Sopranos do, or what they're seeing happening now on HBO.
Yeah.
But they don't quite get what made that its thing and be able to do it in a context of network television. And then at that point, you're having to write these characters into this plot that you don't really care about these characters too much. You care about the new characters you're writing, and then those other people suffer. But again, I'm getting off on a tangent.
Well, no, you're not. Why don't we dive right into that scene then and talk about the problematic aspects of it? So Tammy comes to work, she runs inside, and she seems pretty frantic. And tell me what's problematic with this scene. You have a lot to say on this. I want to hear.
It's not so much here, it's later. And we'll get into that. Yeah.
I found this problematic as well.
I'd like to hear what you think, because I may agree with you. I just think it gets worse. So
it does get worse, but I feel like it starts pretty early on. So she is listening to the message. She's called the B word on the message, which we had heard earlier. It was Carlton Chase who had called the company and left a voicemail on her own machine. Which I found strange, because she's obviously going to be the first one to listen to it, but whatever, that's fine. So not only has she been called a bad word, her boss comes in, tells her to make the coffee, and tells her stupid ain't cute. And all of a sudden you're like, okay, toxic work environment. This is not how people should be treated in any work. And I understand that it does happen, but you would just hope that it wouldn't happen. So right off the bat, I was surprised by their interaction. And I assumed that you had been talking about this, or this is one of the things you were talking about anyway.
Yeah, it's an issue, and that it's definitely a tricky one to explore. There is the representation of repugnant, you know, morals or behavior. And then there is the presentation of it. So there is the existence of it in the story doesn't bother me as much, in the sense of this is a commonplace occurrence even today, and we're dealing with villains or antagonists as a way to highlight the moral problems with those characters. But then there is the fact that it can get pushed into an exploitative space where the lensing of it, the way that the director and the writer are doing to make it amp up or more sensational for people. And for example, like you were talking about the slur that was used, is it necessary? What does that add? So Dwight, played by Michael Bowen, walking in, making the comment about the coffee, and treating Tammy in that way already gets everything across you need to.
Sure.
You don't need to go that far. And that's where I'm using the word trashy. And later there's a couple scenes that really amp it up to where it's completely unnecessary. And if I can court controversy and go off on a tangent,
sure.
Is the ultimate debating Rorschach test for this, if this helps anyone understand what my rambling is trying to get at. Have you ever watched Twin Peaks?
Yeah.
Did you ever see the Fire Walk With Me film?
I did, but it was a while ago.
Okay. It's one of those things, I think it's a wonderful Rorschach test for film that fits here, that you have a script that on its own, if you read the script, is dealing with these very intense topics of abuse. We don't have to go into too many details, but there's overlap here because we're talking about violence. We're talking about violence against women too, here in this story and in the similar one. And there is a need by some, you can see an artistic potentially justification for representation and exploring these themes. But then there's a point of where the director can cross over and you go, why is the director filming this character this way? Why is the director showing this action in this light? And to put my cards on the table, Lynch's lensing of the character in Fire Walk With Me is completely contradictory in how glossy and sexualized it is to what the script is doing. And to a lesser degree, that is what's happening here. It gets worse later in the episode because it's trying to add a texture, again, a sensationalism, an exploitation angle to the presentation of it as opposed to the element itself. So it goes back to the over-the-top angle. And that's why it not only bothers me, it weakens the episode.
Which scene specifically? Which part exactly are you talking about?
There's a scene later where Dwight pressures Tammy into the office, and the camera lingers as she undresses, and you get a front shot of it's unnecessary. Why is that there? Why do you need to see that? But the camera stays on it, and the X-Files would not have done that other than we think back to the pilot,
right?
That scene with Mulder and Scully, that they learned their lesson. They were pressured into doing that allegedly by the production company and Fox. But at this point now, season eight, why did the director choose to do that? Or why, even if it was in the script, what does that add to the story? It doesn't tell me anything else about their relationship. It's simply there to be exploitative and feel gross because of, but I don't think it's in an effective way. And that's where I get back to the Lynch issue, because I'm already feeling for the character as much as I need to, because I know what Tammy's been going through. I already know these issues. And just simply Dwight asking her to come into the office, they could cut and I get everything I need to know about that dilemma.
Right.
But to linger on it for 5 seconds or whatever else, and then repeat a similar shot later in Tammy's apartment, which isn't as bad because there's at least some body language that they're adding to it, like she realizes being washed, but still unnecessary. You didn't need to do it. So why did you do it? What does it add? And then considering, again, the content of the script and what the script is talking about, you're at this point, are you just completely avoiding the ethics and you're just adding this character dynamic to make it more dramatic? And so you're not actually addressing any of the ethics of the real world situation. So there are no themes to this episode. And not to totally jump ahead, but that's where the episode ends. What is it trying to say? What is, and this is where I'd like to get your take, is like, really, I know we don't have to jump ahead, we can stay here, but where Tammy's character ends up and how the episode portrays that versus what she's going through, what is the tone? What is the message of this episode? It is very unclear, which makes, again, the presentation and exploitation of her character and the way it's shot even more problematic for me.
Right. I don't know what the point is. I don't know that there is a specific theme or lesson. It more so seems like the, I don't know if I want to say exploration of these three broad archetypes, the mistreated Tammy, the aggressive Dwight, and the maybe not so bright muscle of Randall, who is mostly being taken advantage, well, he is being taken advantage of by both his brother and Tammy. And I don't know what it's trying to say with all those. That's a really good point. It didn't need to linger on Tammy in the office. We got it. Yeah, I'm not quite sure.
If maybe as an analog, if I get your take on Randall. So similarly with Tammy, the episode doesn't really seem to be clear about whether it thinks she's justified in her actions or if she's this evil manipulative person. It's not clear. Like, you're supposed to sympathize with her, but then at the end she's kind of portrayed as an antagonist and a betrayer. And Randall, we're supposed to sympathize with Randall, but yet he has been a peeping Tom and a creep
and a killer
the entire episode. Yeah, and a killer. Yeah. I mean, but just the relationship between the two of them.
Oh, sure.
Towards the end of the episode, my interpretation of the director of this and the author, the writer, is that they're trying to make you sympathize with him. Like, oh, he's this misunderstood person. And that gets into that awful line that Anderson has to deliver at the end, where I'm supposed to all of a sudden, you know, saw into, and not to cut ahead, but, you know, saw something in her. Where is this in the rest of this episode? And why am I supposed to feel bad for somebody who has been stalking this poor individual? And then additional to all these other hyper creepy things, but tonally, again, I'm supposed to stop sympathizing with Tammy, who has been abused and stole money from drug dealer killers, and she's the bad guy now. I mean, I know it doesn't really make her out to be the bad guy,
but she's not completely innocent either.
But the way that the show treats her at the end tonally isn't like it leaves the victim space. And then goes into, ooh, it's this duplicitous, clever, whether good or bad, but probably leaning towards bad criminal, you know, who betrayed Randall and is this, you know, mean, manipulative person, is really kind of dumb and gross. And one of the reasons overall, I'm not saying every show, every TV show has to have a theme. It has to deal with ethics. But when you're going to be introducing things like this and you don't have a point, it better be really engaging and really smart if you're going to make me dismiss the fact that you're saying some things potentially that are problematic in the way that they mimic real world frequent, you know, common activities that there is very limited accountability for. It's an uncomfortable thing to wrestle with.
I was very surprised by her line at the end. And I was wondering if I had missed something where she, Tammy specifically, was more redeemable. But I don't think that's the case after hearing you speak.
It also kind of goes back into this trope that this is unrequited love and that Randall was well-meaning in what he was doing and that, you know, he was just, there is that, it's really creepy. It really is. And then the fact that it's obfuscating that what was the relationship was him acting as a stalker, killing people around her, and then watching her, like literally the apartment next to her, and then watching through the walls. And at the end, we're like, yeah, he saw into her soul. I'm thinking, you know, it was such a rug pulled out from under me moment that at that point I lost any faith I had in the writer and the director. There are a lot of things I will praise about this episode, but that's why I guess when we started talking, I kind of front-ended the discussion talking about the background. And I think they're playing in waters that they don't have the experience to play in. So I'm not saying they're not talented people and they don't have skills, but I think they're dealing with stuff that is outside of their grasp.
The writer and director specifically, or the X-Files?
The writer and the director.
Yeah.
Because again, the cast, like Dwight played by Michael Bowen, who really gave me like an Anthony Michael Hall vibe. And he seems really campy throughout. And I'd like to get your take on that of all the actors, but he seems like a good actor.
Yeah.
He's doing a good job, but it seems like the director is really, I'm guessing the director is having to push him in those directions. Cause there's a couple scenes where I think he's allowed to breathe. And we'll get to those where it really comes through. But yeah, I'm repeating myself. Let me turn it back over to you. Sorry to run the show too much.
No, that's okay. I like where we're going. We don't have to go scene by scene. It's okay to skip around and talk themes rather than take it scene by scene, as I said. I guess from there, Scully and Doggett are investigating. And speaking of jokes, they are at Chase Realty or real estate. What is it called exactly? Something like that. They walk into Chase Real Estate, which is just a mile from the police station where Carlton Chase ended up being killed. And they're investigating the room shot with a bunch of bullet holes. And Doggett has the audacity to make an Elvis joke. How dare he? Doesn't he know that's Mulder's job? I don't know if you were bothered by that.
I totally forgot, honestly, that would be a Mulder joke because of,
oh my goodness,
all the classic, and is it from Never Again, where he actually visits Graceland? So you're totally right. I was just bothered because it was totally off and was one of the first jokes that really didn't land.
It didn't land. That's true.
So that's what bothered me. So I didn't even have the time to make the other connection. So thank you for doing that. So it's doubly ouch.
Yeah, I don't know what he was referring to about the room with the holes in it. And that's something that Elvis would do, right?
It's an old story, I guess, where he shot a TV and maybe some walls or something.
Okay.
But I'm not an expert. I'll have to look it up. We can correct us. But
that's
I've seen it parodied in other things like The Simpsons.
Can just let us know. Tag us on Twitter or something and let us know what that's about. Because I didn't know. And I thought it didn't land more so because I was upset that it was a Mulder or it should have been a Mulder joke, but I know I'm biased.
It's a fair bias to have though. That is a completely fair. I'm backing you.
Thank you so much. Do we want to talk at all about the warehouse where Dwight and Randall steal the money from the drug dealers and the drugs?
Yes. Yes. And before, if I may, I want to get your take.
Oh, I'm sorry to skip ahead.
Oh, no, that's fine. That's fine, because there's so many things we talk about. But just in my notes, one of the other highlights of the episode, there are two production set pieces that I think really show the team doing what they're doing very well and kind of work with the themes that we're talking about that I think the show could have gone in, the episode could have gone in. And one of those is that short scene where Randall is out in the alley and outside the exterminator place with the dumpster, and the scene with him smashing the rat was incredibly effective and disturbing. Well played, well staged, well edited. I just wanted to highlight it as a great moment of horror.
That is a great point. I'm sorry that we skipped over that. Yeah, I did think that it was one of the better scenes of the episode.
It's short, but it was good.
And gross.
Oh, very,
very, very gross.
But I think if they want to go prestige television dark and they're trying to go that direction, that's, I think, a better direction to go, and that they are capable of doing it. But partially this kind of goes back to the repeating thing, and I'll try to make this one the last times I mention it, is the production, the director of photography, the set designers, the lighting people. Holy smokes, they're all incredibly talented. And that scene there where you don't really have any direction cues too much and you don't have any writing and let the team do what they can do, it's still worth a round of applause. And so even if I have these other issues with the script and everything else in the production, to see an episode in season 8, the fact that they turned these out so quickly is just really, there's a lot to appreciate around the edges of this episode, I guess that's what I'll say. But the core is an issue. And to get to that, let's talk about these drug dealers and this scene and logic. Does it exist?
In this episode, probably not. I just want to say that you should always praise the people behind the scenes, because they are the people who never hear it, or at least not never, but they don't hear it as often as, say, David or Jillian, Chris Carter, Frank Spotnitz. They're always going to get the praise, and it's the people behind the scenes who help so much to make it happen and kind of make these scenes come to life, as much as David or Jillian and the writers and the directors. And they are sometimes the unsung heroes. So I appreciate that you mentioned that, because if something works so well, I often don't think about how well it works and why. So I'm glad that you took note of it.
Thank you for indulging me or allowing me to. Yeah, but I'll turn it back over to you. I keep hijacking things. So back to the warehouse of the drug dealers.
There is no hijacking. We're just having a conversation. Okay. This is just a chat about an episode of The X-Files. So we can take it in all different directions. So the scene where Dwight and... So this is where I had a problem with the stealing of the drugs and the money. I thought that Dwight had to have so much trust in his brother's aim from behind a wall, because even if you're trying to shoot someone who's not behind a wall, from, I don't know, 20, 50 feet away, I'm not quite sure how far away it was, that's not always easy. And he's standing, so I believe Dwight was standing between some of those drug dealers and his brother behind him. And he points his fingers at each drug dealer and pretends to shoot them dead with his finger while his brother's actually doing the work behind him. And I just don't see how that would happen without Dwight being hit. There has to be a mistake at some point in the, I assume, years that they're doing this, where he's going to accidentally be shot, right? Like, am I crazy here?
Not at all. And that goes to many issues of logic on this episode, and you hit so many of them, which is wonderful. The first is, he seems unnaturally good at marksmanship. Where is the background they could have written into the character of training? Could have been in the military, could have shown a proficiency, at some awards. We don't really get that. There's no assumption about distance. And the other issue is deflection. So not only can see-through walls, so they're armor piercing, but I'm not a gun expert, but honestly, you're gonna, bullets when they hit surfaces, that affects the trajectory. And so you're talking about a level of competency and prediction that is supernatural. And I get it, sure, kill. But the episode just keeps going back to, well, it's just x-ray vision. It's very clearly more is happening. And not to, here I go, I'm jumping again all the way to the end. But at the very end, we get a POV shot of the bullet flying. And if you slow the, and I know this is just a camera choice, but it shows the bullet through the POV of the camera go through a spray canister, like a bug spray kind of a thing. That would either explode and cause trajectory changes, or it's going to hit the metal. But instead, it just keeps going through. It's going through this wood. It's not going to change. So the gun aspect, really, we're in cartoon land, which is fine. The X-Files can deal with that. But if you're going to be trying to drag it down into realism and spending so much time over and over again on the X-ray vision, they had a lot of space where they could have explored some of these other angles. Like, well, it just has the supernatural sense. We don't get any of that. Two, another logic issue, which you mentioned before, yeah, the trust angle, but it makes this assumption so that Dwight is going to go into these people who are already on edge. They're drug dealers. They're cartoonishly portrayed. May I mention again, this is where the humor is just awful. I mean, the line, cap his ass, are you kidding me? And the Chris Rock line. But then you're going to walk in and assume that you're going to have time after you shoot someone, count to three. No one else is going to pull a gun and shoot you.
Yeah.
And I know this is a TV show. I get it. But you're trying to play in the realm of like prestige television here. This would never happen. Dwight would be dead. There's no reason for Dwight to walk in there other than, hey, I'm on a TV show and this would be cute. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to copy the old movie Real Men. I think it was with Jim Belushi, which had the same scene in John Ritter where they did the finger guns thing. So this happens. And then to cut to the next scene, find out that this is the fifth drug ripoff that they've done in this manner. And the cops have not noticed a pattern of people shooting people through walls to connect it to the original death of Chase. This sequence here completely upends the entire logical thread of the episode. And at this point, you just tuned out.
Right. I guess that's why they called in the FBI. They didn't know how to do their jobs. I don't know. One would think that at a certain point, I was going to say the LAPD, but it was in Massachusetts, would have figured it out that someone was shooting holes through walls and killing people, but they did not. I don't know. I'm not quite sure how they missed such a big thing. However, just to go back, I don't think I would have bumped on that Chris Rock joke had the Oscars not happened just 10 days ago. And now it kind of perked me up. I'm sure if you hadn't watched the Oscars, I'm sure you've at least heard about it.
Yes, but okay. Just like the similar thing with me not connecting Elvis with Mulder, I didn't even think about that.
Oh, that's
I'm going
so
to blame it on just too much. Yeah, it's just been too many crazy work weeks. So my brain is
okay.
I'm just in this very present state and not in a healthy way.
Oh, I was going to say that sounds so mindful of you,
doesn't it? But no, it's the opposite, mindless.
Oh, okay.
I appreciate the moral, the positive spin on things.
Yeah. Well, I mean, from there, we can go to the Clark Kent joke that Doggett ends up making, right? When
do any of them work for you? Any of them at all?
No. The only reason I was thinking, is Chris Rock funny? I don't know. I have moral conflictions about this one. Was he funny in the 90s? That one I had to think about just because of what has happened now. But obviously I'm looking at it with this new pop culture issue that has come up. No, that one didn't work for me. But also just because, as you mentioned, the cartoonish nature of the drug dealers, you know who's funny? Chris Rock is funny. I don't know. It was just so silly. I'm laughing not because it's funny, but because it was so awkward and seemingly out of nowhere. Whereas at least Doggett's joke, I understand. He makes a joke about Clark Kent when Scully is suggesting in her very scientific way that the human eye can only see small portions of the electromagnetic spectrum, and maybe this person has a different spectrum that he or she can see. And so that joke, at least I got, but it wasn't funny. It didn't quite land. I don't know about you.
No, it didn't. And I think that goes back to the direction and the writing. It doesn't feel right for the character. And it is sort of harking back, which I think you correctly noted, to Mulder, but you need Duchovny to pull that off. And you often would need him to improv to make that work, to be able to sell. Like, this is forced. It is an issue. And that kind of goes back to the Chris Rock line and then cap his ass. Those drug dealers were the least realistic looking drug dealers in their acting. And
yeah,
they're just relying on stereotypes to make you think, oh, they're, I don't mean to go here, but really, it really is. It is this bad that, oh, they're non-white and they're going to use slang like Chris, you know, talk about Chris Rock and they're going to say cap his ass. And that's what we get to that they're drug dealers. And so they're going to put those words in their mouth to emphasize it and make it a little quirkier. It does not land. It's very paint by numbers, regressive, boring TV writing, you know, like Law and Order circa 1998.
Right. Now, let me ask you something about Doggett in this episode specifically. Do you think that the writer was almost not trying to write for Mulder, but taking cues from previous episodes and kind of using some of those jokes, but putting them in Doggett's mouth? Because all these jokes, I can see Mulder saying, but it doesn't work for Doggett.
I can't argue with that. I think your observation is right.
Okay.
They're different characters, and I don't know enough about the writer to know where, you know, what their background is, but maybe just if they aren't that familiar with the quote unquote writing Bible for Doggett in season 8, and maybe just thinks, oh, this is the X-Files has to have banter. Well, last thing I watched was Home, and Duchovny acted this way, so I'm going to write it this way. But I at least know enough to make Scully the believer, allegedly. I mean, so there is awareness to that degree. There's also the fact that Doggett's new, and at this time they probably wouldn't have been able to actually see any of the performances of Robert Patrick and not really know how to write for him.
That's a good point.
I'm less bothered by it. If this was in season 9, I think it would be a bigger issue. I guess I say I'm more forgiving of those missteps, but that doesn't mean it works at all. And Robert Patrick, I've mentioned many times, I think is excellent and an incredible casting choice. And I like the character of Doggett, but with this attempt to, I think you're getting at something really nice, which is there is a, I think, a reticence by some of the fan base to accept Doggett as a character, as a way to make the X-Files function post-Mulder. Mm-hmm. And when the script and the direction tries to force Doggett into the Mulder role, that's only going to exacerbate that problem. So I think this episode itself is an example of why they may have had those additional difficulties.
Yeah.
Because the clarity just wasn't there, and it's just a pale imitation.
And I have to admit, I was one of those people, and it took me a long time to accept Doggett, but right. You can't write for him, for Robert Patrick, the way you would have written for Duchovny. They're just, or for Mulder and Doggett, and they're just different characters.
Yeah. It underserves both of them.
Yeah.
As a whole in the total of the show. And it makes that transition difficult. So I'm very sympathetic that it would be difficult to make that switch.
Absolutely. I will say though, that Doggett comes up with a newly discovered piece of evidence, the sulfuryl fluoride on the towel, which is great. And that brings them to the offices of AAA1 Shurkill, where, well, they're not quite there yet. We start with Tammy counting the money in the money machine. We did talk about this actually. So we can skip ahead to when, do you want to skip ahead to when the FBI gets there?
Because sounds great.
Yeah. Now, not important to the show at all, or to this episode at all, but did you notice James Franco was listed in the credits as one of the cops?
I read about that, but honestly, I did not actually spot him. I think I was looking at other things. Did you spot him this time?
I tried so hard. I watched the scene 3 times. I kept rewinding. The police officers are never in focus, and it could be him. I mean, I'm sure it is. I just couldn't spot him. Not that I'm a particularly big fan of James Franco or anything, but I was so shocked because I didn't know. I never knew that he was in an X-Files episode. And so I tried really, really hard to find him and I couldn't. I was wondering if you had any better luck.
No, I even failed to remember to look.
Oh, okay.
I really dropped the ball.
It's okay. They were always in the background, never in focus, behind things. So yeah. You wouldn't have seen him. In this particular scene where the FBI comes in, is there anything that you want to touch upon?
If I may jump again on the logic issue.
Yes.
Of where they're forcing the dynamic. So Dwight asked Tammy what she thought about Carlton calling there. and interrogates her, basically pushing about, oh, a message must have been left. And then Tammy says she accidentally hit the erase button. Why in the world, script-wise, would they think they could pull this off? They had a scene, the highest tension scene other than the cold open in the entire episode is where Dwight walks in and saw the blinking light on the answering machine earlier. Mm-hmm. There was the panic. Tammy presses play. They both heard the message. Why would he have any reason to believe there was another message before that? The assumption was at that point, Tammy came in, that would be the messages that were there would hit it. Answer machines don't, in my world, have never worked where you do a message and then it keeps blinking. You hit another button. They just play. She had a complete perfect alibi, but instead she gives up the ghost here because the writer needs to do this. There's so many other ways they could have done it, but this was the next big logical leap for us. Okay. Really took me out of the story.
Yeah.
Because it just completely subverted that earlier episode. And you think is Tammy otherwise comes across as an incredibly intelligent character. And then this happens. What were your thoughts?
Yeah, similar. I don't know that I have much more to add to that. I will say that after the police officers and Doggett and Scully leave and Dwight looks her in the eye, he sparks the cigarette lighter and he looks at her. This is also where we find out that he's blind. And I did not realize that earlier in the episode. I don't know if you had, but I did not catch on to that at all.
The character tried to, goes back to the over the top thing, did his best, the actor did his best to, you know, overly squint often and have that facial tick, but
I didn't catch that.
Other than that, it's not totally clear, but it's just a hint like, oh, if one of these has the superpower and the other one has the deficit.
Right. I was surprised by that. That was a fun surprise for me. I didn't catch that throughout the episode. And as you were saying, you know, they needed this lapse in logic to make this work. But I did find it very interesting and very effective when, as I was saying, Dwight sparks that cigarette lighter and looks her in the eye and asks her if she's lying. He says that the eyes are the window to the soul. And that was really creepy and just goes along with his aggressive demeanor. And maybe it was over the top, but I thought it really worked, it, you know, to be the fire playing, you know, off her features and how close he is to her. It was very creepy.
Completely agree. And earlier talked about the rat and the dumpster scene, and there are two highlights from the episode for me, and this is the second. Totally agree. And my notes, same thing. This is where everything is tonally right. The performances by both the actors is great. The episode's allowed to breathe for that moment, and we actually get it doesn't feel contrived in the same way. And the fact that it even came off of that contrived answer machine message, and they're still able to play the tension off that well. And like you said, the flame, it just looks great. It's threatening. It's textured. The production team is on their A game. The actors are doing great. Give credit to the director. That was an excellent scene. So it added a 0.5 to the episode just for that scene.
Nice.
Alone.
Okay. Yeah, no, it was really good. I'm glad I'm not the only one who thought that it was so effective. Is there something that you wanted to touch upon?
Not so much in that scene. All my notes are later at the police station or after.
Okay, why don't we head over to the police station then and do that?
But I'm happy to talk about anything that you have before. I don't. Yeah.
Okay. Well, then if you could just give me one second. You know what? I guess I do want to say that Tammy looked familiar to me. And she was played by Kelly Waymire. And I had to look her up. It turns out that she died in 2003 at the age of 36. And she was in Playing by Heart with Jillian in 1998. And that must be where I know her from, but I can't think of her character. But I thought that was really sad. I can't believe she died at such a young age.
Yeah, I didn't know that. That's awful.
Yeah, she was also in Star Trek Voyager and Enterprise and 6 Feet Under. I'm assuming she was in makeup. Heavy makeup in Voyager and Enterprise, and I probably didn't recognize her. But yeah, she looks like one of those characters from the late 90s, early 2000s that I'm like, where do I know her from? And so I was very surprised to find that out.
I had the same issue with Patrick Kilpatrick, who played Randall's. Like, I recognize him from somewhere. And then I looked up on IMDb, he's been in like over 170 films and TV episodes. So it's like, yeah. I don't know which one I saw him in, but I've seen him before.
He was in one of those. That's for sure. Yeah. You must have seen, I'm sure you saw him in a bunch of stuff. He looked familiar to me as well. Doggett and Scully find out that they're twins. Randall and Dwight are twins. They'd been arrested before. I thought it was really funny that Doggett says, and funny in a bad way, twins. I hate twins. They never rat each other out or something, which I don't know that that's true. It was such a weird line.
I agree. 100%.
Yeah.
What does that mean? How many twins have you interrogated, Doggett?
I mean,
what world are we in here?
You never know.
He was on the child recovery task force and then the twin prosecution task force. Eventually.
So he's had a lot of experience.
Show. Yeah.
We talked about Tammy watching, or I'm sorry, Randall watching Tammy.
Yeah. Although I do have a small comment here, if I may,
sure.
Just to get your thought on one of the issues for the episode. It's a minor one, but it's not really clear how his vision works. And it seems to change from episode or scene to scene.
You mean Randall?
Randall. Yeah. So how's vision? So here we're when he's in Tammy's apartment, it's a little bit different than some of the other ones, but it zooms in, you get 1080p, but then there's a vignette around the outside.
Yeah.
So it's clearly not x-rays because we're getting full color. And they could have easily done an effect like an x-ray or something. I mean, not easily, but they could have done something or, you know, done an inversion on the camera or something. But instead, it's portrayed that way. Later, it's clear and it shows him like zooming through and it's taking time or like we're seeing, like, how do we know, how does it work? Like, how does he know where his vision is going to stop? Let's say it's magic. Let's just go along with it. But he sees through wall X. Does he just keep squinting until he goes through the next wall and then he adjusts the distance with his eyes in a 3D space and then can somehow localize it? And I know it's like x-rays in Superman movies. I get it. But the problem is because we're having to connect it to real actions, like later in the next scene, exactly. And I'm sorry to skip ahead there.
That's okay.
But Doggett and Scully show up right at the last minute to save Tammy from being caught regarding the ledger. And Randall doesn't notice the cops are outside or coming in. But later at the bus station, he does, like, sees the cops coming around the corner. So it's just about, like, how quickly can he recognize things? Like, and then how does that space perception work? Because the camera shows it with like a slow zoom. Again, this is a minor thing, but it's difficult for me as a viewer to really understand what are the rules and what's happening. So it just seems, instead, it's almost as if it might be better just to create a character who has remote viewing and can simply psychically project at a distance and is aware or can see things about space and not use vision in the same sense, because it just doesn't make a lot of sense. Because even the camera, the way the camera shows it, changes from scene to scene. So I don't even have a clear view of like what it's supposed to happen.
So in the scene with Tammy, I took that more as an artistic choice because she's supposed to be beautiful. He's in love with her. It's a very intimate moment for her as she's getting into the shower. So she's not fully clothed. I took that not so much as his sight, but maybe the way he views her in a romantic sense. And I agree with you. Like, how far can he see? When can he stop it? I just assumed he had more control over it than we realize. I tried not to think too much about it because if I do, it takes me too far out of the story. But, you know, he needs to see over there. He looks in that direction. He zooms in as far as he wants to or until he sees the thing that he wants to see. Yeah, I don't know why he didn't see Scully and Doggett and the FBI coming the second time around in the offices. That I didn't make an assumption for.
It's just minor, but only because two scenes later, the bus station, that exact same thing of being warned by the cops coming is a plot point. And there's much more visual stimulus there that would be even harder to notice, to even be looking out for it. While if you're in a quiet environment and there's that kind of movement, it just seems. And also that kind of goes back to the next scene in The Exterminator. And we could back up after this, goes back to the point I'm talking about where it feels like this episode is structured around the side characters solely, because literally Doggett and Scully just happen to show up within a millisecond of Tammy basically being in enormous trouble. And then again, that just takes me away, takes me out of it a little bit. And yeah. I don't mean to harp so much on the X-ray thing other than the X-Files and going back to season 8, where it tries to be a little bit more grounded, or when it can't be grounded, it doesn't show too much. It tries mm-hmm. sometimes. And here, I think it's just not, it's in that in-between space where it doesn't feel, it feels more at home with like something like the other episodes this, the crew had worked on, or the director and the writer, something like Dark Angel or Voyager or something, where you can get away with some of these leaps.
Right.
And the X-Files is just a little bit more grounded traditionally than this, and it just feels a little bit more incongruous.
Right. It's bordering more on fantasy than maybe science fiction or science itself.
Yeah. And if they could lean further into it, that would be fine. But it's just in that, lukewarm state.
Yeah. It's an interesting concept, though, to have X-ray vision.
Sure.
I'm not against it.
No, I mean, it's season 8. You only have so many ideas, and to be able to rework the tombs idea of like, how does somebody get into a space where they couldn't get into and do something new with it? Yeah, it's not a bad idea. It's just a few missteps.
Right. I also like, and to kind of go back to tombs and the vent, I like that they walk in the vent, but obviously it's much bigger this time. So just a little side note there, not actually important to what we're discussing. Just kind of more like a mental note that I made.
Mental notes are important. Don't
they
knock
are
them.
Important. They are important. Yeah, I guess the next scene is really the interrogation scene. And nothing too important happens here. Just, what's his name? Randall kind of parroting Dwight and saying, I'm a regular Joe providing a public service if he's asked if they killed anybody or if they're drug dealers or if they steal, basically just a regular Joe.
If I may jump in on that scene.
Sure.
With a little bit of praise, I really like the transition from when Scully's doing the interrogation and then the camera pans through the wall sort of over to Doggett in the other interrogation room. Really slick. I thought it's really nice. Just again to praise the team. And maybe the director had something to do with that too. So I want to give fair play and fair credit. I've been kind of harsh.
Yeah, no, I agree. And to kind of add to that, when after they've interrogated Tammy and she goes home and they kind of, the camera goes back between Doggett and Scully discussing what they think happened or does that come later? Am I getting myself confused here? Tammy goes into Randall's apartment.
I think you're at the right point.
Okay. I mean, we've been skipping all around, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah. But
similarly, I like the way they go back and forth between that, how that's edited and how they kind of work out the story and you see what Tammy's actually doing. And I thought that worked really, really well. I thought it was interesting.
Great point. Totally agree.
Oh, the Star 69. Can we just discuss Star 69?
Please.
That, and I didn't mention the newspaper earlier, maybe I did, that Tammy was reading a newspaper where I was like, people don't do this anymore. I remember Star 69. So for maybe some of the younger people who don't know, when Scully and Doggett are in Tammy's apartment, they notice that she's packed up all her things. They're wondering, where could she possibly have gone? So of course they check the last dialed number. You didn't even need to run a trace. You just Star 69. And I love that she didn't make any calls after that. It was to the bus company, like Concordia Bus Company. So they can find out exactly where she bought tickets for. The logic in that is great. I mean, it could be that it was the very last thing that she did and they got very lucky. I find it hard to believe, but still Star 69, something that I used to do all the time.
No, that's it's a total fair writing point. It's a fun observation. I totally agree with you on that point too. Yeah. It's one of the moments in the detective work. I mean, there are quite a few going throughout, like Scully with a pencil and that are fun and they work well.
Yeah. Even if it maybe doesn't make the most sense, although I guess it could be a coincidence that that's the last number she dialed.
To be fair, Tammy doesn't seem that conspiratorial. I mean, I think it's judicious in covering her tracks.
That's true.
I mean, if she's just having the ledger in that desk in a lockbox, that's why not keep it at home? You know, there's things like that.
Yeah.
It just seems like character is, if you want to think that this character is real, I mean, it's not really shown to be that cautious.
Right. And that's true. And I love that it's just a petty cash box that Doggett can open with a screwdriver. It's just that simple. And it could mean her life. Randall might kill her for it. Luckily for her, she doesn't, not that we want anyone dead, but no one's really innocent in all of this is what I'm saying, I guess.
On the point of innocence, I'd love to get your take then on the conversation between Tammy and Dwight. And how are we supposed to feel? I was really uncomfortable with that scene where Tammy says, Carlton Chase made me do things. And then Dwight says, I bet you put up a big fight.
Right.
Sarcastically. And because the shift of the tone here from now on out is that Tammy is this gray, morally gray, I think the script is trying to show us, person, this just doesn't land right to me. I was thinking, why is this here? I mean, in the one sense, yes, obviously it's clear. You could look at Dwight and go, yeah, that he's a gross guy and that's what he was going to say. But it just didn't come across clear for like how we're as the viewer are supposed to feel. And I'm not saying that it's this hugely overtly negative thing that the writer and the director are trying to portray, but I don't think it was delivered with enough clarity or with enough point or reason to be justified in the way it was portrayed. Is that what I'm making sense? I'm not trying to say that like endorsing this behavior, but it's also like, because I'm not supposed to feel that sympathy for Tammy as much anymore at this point. How am I supposed to feel about this comment?
I don't think that's the case, that you're not supposed to feel sympathy for Tammy. Morally gray is a very good term to probably describe her. I think it's one of those over the top lines that is supposed to signify how despicable Dwight is. I don't know that there's any deeper meaning than that. I don't think that this episode has a lot of deeper meanings. I think it's very surface level.
I think it's implying how I got it, though, is that she's lying, is that there is this fact that because it goes back to the fact that Dwight thinks Randall killed Chase because Chase and Tammy were in a relationship.
Right.
So here the implication is that Tammy is lying about Chase making her do things. And can we go there at this point? The episode does not make it clear either way. We don't know what the relationship was like. We don't know if there was pressure. This is dangerous territory to be playing in my opinion, in ethics. And I know that's a lot to state, but if you're going to play in these waters as a script writer, you need to give it the time and the attention, is again, to repeat myself. So I'm not saying that you shouldn't talk about these things or that this is an inherently, that these people are portraying something that's this evil, malicious, any sort of intent like that. But I'm trying to say, I think it's irresponsible, this grayness here, that they introduce this for kind of a quirk to make Dwight look bad. And again, we don't need that. We already know Dwight is a bad guy. We already know he's a threat and gross. This scene is unnecessary and instead just makes Tammy look like, oh, maybe she was seeing Chase from behind. And so Randall is somewhat more justified in his unrequited love. This just muddies like who am I rooting for at this space? And I know you and I are rooting for, because we're watching it from with hindsight and we're watching Tammy. Sure. But let's take the average viewer and what the script and direction are trying to push people into to view, because it is pretty on the surface. Like everything you said is true. It's on the surface. It's pretty dumb. But certain people who are just going to be passively watching this are going to be pushed in certain directions by the script. That's just the nature of media like this.
That's a good point.
The directions that it's pushing are not great, both in the sense of ethics, but also in the sense of storytelling. Because going back to the final resolution with Randall, and we're supposed to pity him, and the comment about seeing into her heart, tying back up to this thing that she's lying or not lying about a relationship with the person that was killed, that may have been manipulated or may not, and we don't actually get any resolution, but we're trying to actually change our allegiances based on this comment. That's a major misstep, and this is where about 4 points of the score fell off.
I don't have a clear answer for you, and I will say that we have a different lens, the 2020 lens, and where things have changed, and maybe a storyline like this might not be, or this particular line would just be cut from the script. No, this isn't necessary. I don't know. I don't know the writer's intent. I know how it looks and how we don't have an actual answer from Tammy. Was it an affair? You know, is she lying? We don't know. It just seems surface level to me. And I don't know that we're left to make our own decisions about it, come up with our own theories. I don't know.
And that's where the episode feels cheap, because at the end, like, why, you know, watching it carefully, I'm hoping Tammy got away with the drug dealer's money and the people have been abusing her. But the episode kind of makes me feel bad about that, because, or not, or, you know, it's trying to make me sympathize with Randall. So I can't really easily follow any direct path. And because these characters were not fleshed out enough for me to actually get invested, to really care about what these details are, it just muddles it at the end, is, I guess, my point. They spent all of this time in the episode focusing on these characters and not our main characters of Scully and Doggett, and then at the end, shake them up in ways that don't make sense, which gets me to the point of, like, Dwight trying to get Randall to kill Tammy. Like, this is an incredibly terrible plan.
Bad. Yeah.
I know Randall enough and Dwight enough by this point, watching this episode. And I know Dwight enough as a character that he's generally seems relatively competent, because otherwise they wouldn't be able to be doing all of these things, even with the really stupid warehouse drug deal coincidence thing. But in this cartoon world with his confidence, he's the most intelligent person and seems to understand the psychology of Randall, because he has been manipulating Randall his entire life.
Right.
And then thinks, this person who he knows he's so in love with that he killed a colleague of theirs and potentially threatened everything, I know what to do in order to get control over him. I'm going to have him kill this person that he is in love with. To, like, okay. And then you could say, well, he's doing this to show dominance and show this. How is this going to work out in any reality whatsoever? And we're not seeing Dwight angry enough. Of all the scenes where it should have gone over the top, like we've been talking about, this would be the scene where the Dwight character would need to be shown over the top and irrational to push Randall to do it. But instead, he's portrayed incredibly calm and collected, like, this is just what needs to happen. And that does not make sense with what we know from any of the characters at this point.
Yeah.
So all of these interactions and this scene here upend everything we know. So I just stop caring.
That is a very good point about the over the top. I didn't think about that and how he has been that way for so much of the episode, but not in this final scene. It's a strange resolution with no real answers. And I guess, obviously, Randall is the strong, silent type. And whatever Scully had said to him earlier, what were her words exactly? It's time to be your own man. Something like that. Had a more profound effect on him than anything that his brother might be saying. But I don't know that you're supposed to sympathize with anyone, really.
I think we should sympathize with Tammy, because she's in a horribly abusive situation. And the fact that we're trying to make her gray when she's stealing money from drug dealers who have been seemingly sexually abusing her, I don't understand why that needs to be gray. When it's this dumb and surface level of a story, I mean, shouldn't the script go all in and root for her and hooray, she's getting away and gets to do something? It's why it's trying to complexify certain things that there isn't a need to. And then it ends up just adding these things. And then they interject quirky magical logic simply to set pieces that undercut the, you know, any sort of character realization, getting to the point we talked about earlier with the drug dealers. Why would Dwight walk in, put himself at risk, count to five, basically, after Randall shoots him, and just stand there hoping everybody's going to be stunned and not shoot him?
Right.
And now, coincidentally, Dwight walks out of the building from to the right side of Randall, somehow ends up on the other side of the building, 1 inch to the left of where Tammy is standing, but 20 feet back or whatever, mm-hmm. through multiple buildings, and we can shoot through canisters and cement without having any trajectory issues and kill Dwight. The fact that they really expect us to understand the space of this establishment we've been in, and then buy that level of quirk is going to happen and still think, oh, this is a story that's real, that I care about, and that, oh yeah, this woman who's been experiencing a real situation of sexual harassment, and this other Randall who's been abused by this individual, and now we're going to go into magic line and then end up with this twee seeing something in herself ending. It's pretty insulting on multiple levels to me.
It's insulting, and it does leave a lot up to coincidence. It's such a coincidence that he's standing right where he needs to be standing. As for the morals of this episode, I don't know what they were trying to do, but at least I ended up sympathizing with no one.
Everyone, it's not Excelsis Day bad. I'll put that out here, but it is not great.
And it's not even Alpha bad. I disliked Alpha more.
Yeah, Alpha is, well, I guess, yeah, Alpha is boring. This is at least a little bit more interesting than Alpha.
Yeah.
Do you think Alpha is more offensive than this?
I do.
What about it? Oh, the Scully, the way Scully's portrayed?
Scully.
That's pretty awful.
And that's not my Scully. Maybe that's where I feel mm-hmm. so offended, because I view her as this strong, independent, wonderful woman. And she is petty and kind of makes, well, I don't know if she makes fun, but she picks on a woman who has, I forget exactly.
Lupus.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Duh, that makes sense, because Alpha. Yeah. I was just, Scully would never do that. I don't know. I found it so offensive, more so than this one, which isn't great, but like you said, it's not Excelsis Day.
That's fair though. Alpha is rough for all those reasons. Yeah. It's well said.
I take it personal anyway, or personally.
That's fair. Yeah. I just have this issue of this one in particular has its the general characters are served better. Scully and Doggett are served better. But I think I'm not going to make a comparison with Alpha, because they're apples and oranges at this point. But I just have some, I guess my problem is, if you're going to be dumb, be a lot more fun and be a lot more over the top. And that's where I give credit to something like, this is going to cause the controversy, but that's where something like My Struggle 4 works better than this.
Wow.
Because if you're going to be dumb, go nuts, go comic book. And now again, My Struggle 4, if you are caring about the main characters and actually thinking that's a real plot, I can see why it would bother you way more than this. Mm-hmm. I don't want to get that. But when I was watching it, it's just fan fiction at that point. And yeah. It's one person's interpretation. And if I could take that template of energy and put it on this episode of just let's go nuts and just amp it up to 100, this episode could work. And I would be able to shut off my brain and go, okay, whatever. Yeah, this thing happened to set here. But instead, they keep transitioning between feeling this way about this character. Oh, you mean I'm supposed to civilize this character who we just saw stalking this individual, and we just saw somebody murder, or this person who had this thing happen, and then we're going to switch tonally so quickly, but then be so slow and deliberate in our pacing to show our hands. And I know it's the time the television show was made, but really they so over egg these situations about like the setup of where this bolt's going to go and where someone's going to do. So you're constantly being pulled attention to it, mm-hmm. when instead it could just be allowing my brain to stay shut off and just go along for the ride. So that's my long rambling point. I can't go along for the ride because it's not dumb enough and it's not over the top enough, but it's also not interesting enough. And then there are the ethical problems because it's so slow at some points. That also drags me down. So by the time of the end, there are things to like. There are moments to like. There is production to applaud. I mean, the set direction and decoration on this episode and the lighting is incredible. It's beautiful. But in the end, what are we left with? Ooh.
That, unless you have other thoughts, is a really good place to end it.
My only other thought is I just hijacked the ending of this, and I apologize. And thank you for your patience, but good grief.
No, there's no hijacking. We're just having a chat. No big deal. No big deal. Do you want to hop over to the mailbag and check that out?
Love to.
All right.
Although before the mailbag, can I read the line Scully had to deliver?
Yeah.
Just for everybody. So everyone could be as uncomfortable as we had to be.
Yes.
He could look at anything he wants, and he chose her. He must have seen something in her that she couldn't see in herself. So whoever gets to cross stitch that into a nice, a little plaque or not plaque, whatever, something we can hang up on the wall and share that in the Facebook basement, I will. Round of applause.
Yeah, that is a very strange way to end the episode. So I'm going to dive into the mailbag now. Kurt North says, they don't make lighters like that anymore. I don't know that that's true. The lighter that Dwight uses, they still make lighters like that, right?
Maybe in the UK, they've got better safety regulations.
Oh. But
over here in the US of A, you know, things are, yeah, they're still around.
Yeah, I have some. I light my candles with them. Paige Schechter says, my mom always taught me not to say anything nice if I didn't have something nice to say. So I guess she didn't like it so much. Ronald Wilson says, in retrospect, it was nice to see the late, great Kelly Waymire in this otherwise ordinary episode, one of Snow's more interesting scores. So you had noticed his work as well for the post-biogenesis period. Although I guess you were saying that it harkens back. So maybe I spoke incorrectly.
But it could be interesting in the sense that it is a callback, because it sounds like I'd heard it before, but maybe it is just simply that it, like you said, harkens back to season one or two, and it's trying to return to that tone. And so that's good to hear that call out there. And it's also, yeah, I mean, to shout out Kelly Waymire, I think, again, I don't know if I stated this, with the script she's given and the direction, does a great job. I do want to applaud her work and in hindsight.
She does a great job. I agree. Adam Silva says, I think it's an example of someone thinking of a great teaser and then having to unfortunately write an episode to go with it. Cry laugh emoji. The guest actors are fine, but the story just isn't interesting, and it barely matters that Scully and Doggett are there at all, which is something that we did touch upon. And then AJ Black says, I've said this before and I've said it again, absolutely banging pre-credit sequence here with a guy running into the police station. Thrilling, tense, superbly executed, and then it goes to shit. And the rest is just absolute Dullsville. Anderson and Patrick look bored as fuck. The script goes nowhere fast. And Randall is such a morose, internal, sympathetic villain. It's hard to care about him. Just bland. And then it goes on a little bit. It says, the kind of episode you feel the glory years for Mulder and Scully never would have got past the pitching stage. Ouch. So people don't love it.
Yeah, it's hard to love.
It's hard to love.
But I am glad that there is some appeal there and agreement for some of the production end. Like they're talking about the energy of the opening, the cold open.
That's true.
Just watching it this time back where I'm focusing on, I suppose, just intaking the episode passively, but really looking at the editing and focusing on realizing, wow, they put an enormous amount of work into that cold open to make it exciting.
That's true.
The editor and the director of photography, it's outrageous. And that's where the budget went.
Yeah.
Although, again, we talked about the show, some other good scenes. There are some other things to appreciate, other moments of value.
Agreed. And any final thoughts on the episode?
No. Thanks for all the great feedback, though, folks, on the mailbag. The late turnaround time, we appreciate that.
Yes, that's true. That was posted just a few minutes before we started recording. So thank you so much. And thank you to Russ for coming on to discuss this with me today. I loved your insights. You saw things that I did not see, and that's always enjoyable.
Well, same back to you. This was an absolute blast. Thank you for taking the time and letting me join. And I look forward to future XCast presentations.
Yeah. And where can we find you on social media?
Just in the basement. I don't have time or the mental energy to participate in any other spheres. I'm a tired, tired soul.
Understandable.
And honestly, the XCast basement is like the only spiritually pleasant and friendly social media space on the internet left, it seems, the way things go. So cheers for that.
Oh, I love to hear that.
It's the anti-Twitter in that sense. Like, there's debates, but they're generally very friendly.
That
not
is
soul destroying.
Wonderful to hear. I love it. Yeah, Twitter can be a toxic place, she says as she's about to promote her Twitter page. You can find me on Twitter at Banani. That's BANANNIE _X. And you can find the XCast on Twitter at the X_cast and on the Facebook group, the X-Files Basement, the XCast podcast fan group. And remember, trust no one.
Elsewhere on We Made This.
Shipwrecked and Comatose, a Red Dwarf podcast.
This was one you requested, Matt. Was there any particular reason?
Part of it is because it meant that I got to get onto Out of Time.
Oh, okay, so that was the reason. Fine.
Yeah, no, so yeah, ask me that question again when we do episode 2 of season 10.
I think I know what you're talking about on that particular episode that you might want to be on.
Episode 1, yeah.
Yes.
But also, I think I'm quite a big Rimmer fan, and I always find Rimmer-centric episodes interesting, dependent on their quality. And this and the next episode, and I don't really want to go into something that is more relevant for next episode.
Free with this month's issue.
Talking about double bass, do you ever play double bass?
No, I have touched a double bass, but I've never actually played it. I'll stick with my five-string Warwick, and that'll be all right.
The only time I've ever played one was the short period I was at university. They got one in the music room there, and I used to play it on its side like a normal bass. Although I'm nowhere near as big as Pete Steele from Typo Negative, so it was even more ridiculous when I did it than when he does it.
Movieversaries podcast.
Yeah, I like, you know, A New Hope. I like Strikes Back. I like The Last Jedi. I think Revenge of the Sith is pretty good. But like Rise of Skywalker can just...
Rise of Skywalker is terrible.
Yeah, it's terrible. You know what I mean?
On our podcast, we're big fans of The Last Jedi, and we do not like Rise of Skywalker at all.
Oh, maybe I'll fit right in then.
Maybe you'll fit right in.
But yeah, I can offer maybe a controversial take. Like, for example, I think The Return of the Jedi is not good.
Get out.
Hey man, this is my podcast. You get out.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.
The XCast and X-Files podcast was created by Tony Black and is produced and hosted by Carl Sweeney, Sarah Blair and Kurt North.
You can find the podcast on Twitter at @X_cast, on Facebook by typing in the XCast, and in our group, X-Files Basement, the XCast podcast fan group, and on Instagram at the XCast pod.
Don't forget, you can support the show by becoming a member on Patreon. Our patrons get early access to episodes, behind-the-scenes chats with our hosts and a thriving community of X-Files, and other premium interviews and specials. To find out more and subscribe, you can go to patreon.com/thexcast. That's patreon.com/thexcast.
We are also part of the We Made This podcast network, full of popular culture shows, including our Millennium series, The Time Is Now. You can find all of our shows at our website, wemadethispod.com, or via Twitter at @wemadethispod.
Thanks for listening and keep watching the skies.